You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Connor. Happy Earthling Day.
Hey, Andrew. Happy Earthling Day to you, too.
So for those who don't know, this is Earthling Unplugged, a special edition of the Non-Zero Podcast where we talk about items from The Earthling, the weekend edition of Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack, which you and Robert Wright and I write together every week. And in Earthling Unplugged, we also share hot takes and stray thoughts on current events. Right now, it's just obviously you and me, Connor. But people should know we're going to have a very special mystery guest come in for actually like an hour at the end of this, you know, of us talking. I don't want to spoil it. I guess I can say his first name is Robert. He goes by Bob. He should be very familiar to fans of the Non-Zero Podcast. I mean, what else can I say? He's writing a book on AI. Do you have any tantalizing hints by way of describing him?
I'm afraid that you might give it away at this point. We're getting awfully close. I don't know. Let's leave it at that. Let's leave people on the edge of their seats, I think. And maybe the best way for us to go this time is just to... I think we've got a little bit more banter in the conversation that y'all are going to see with the mystery guest. So we're going to get down to brass tacks here. And we're going to start talking about it.
Although I will say, if you really want to know who the special guest is, you could probably look on the thumbnail if you're on YouTube. But okay. Now, let's go ahead and jump into the lead item. Which is about the news that North Korean troops have traveled to Russia for training and presumably in anticipation of joining the Russian side in the war against Ukraine. The Ukrainian and South Korean governments have been saying this was happening or that it might happen for a couple weeks now. And then we saw more reports about it last week, but a lot of people thought that Kyiv and Seoul were kind of getting ahead of the evidence a little. Zelensky, of course, has an incentive to kind of hype the threat against Ukraine for understandable reasons in order to pressure the West to, you know, provide more military assistance. South Korea, which has incredibly tense relations with North Korea right now, is also hyper attentive to what its northern neighbor is up to. But this week, U.S. officials and NATO officials also have said that at least 3,000 North Korean troops have indeed traveled to Russia for training. And the way the New York Times reports it, you know, these U.S. officials say the North Korean troops are indeed there to join the war against Ukraine. So up to now, the only foreign fighters in Ukraine, you know, the only third country fighters, I should say, have been individual volunteers, military advisors and trainers, and like small numbers of NATO special forces. So this represents a, you know, if this happens, if the North Korean troops really do join the war effort, it represents a pretty significant widening of the Russia-Ukraine war. Obviously, I have some things to say about this development, but Connor, what was your kind of general reaction to the story?
Yeah, I think my first reaction is again that it's an interesting development insofar as it's just this kind of the slow broadening of the war, right? I think that in the early days, I know that when I was covering this, what people were really worried about was this kind of rapid escalation to a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. There was a lot of fear that, you know, NATO might do a no-fly zone or something like that that would put us in direct combat, essentially, with Russian forces. But now we're seeing this kind of almost boil the frog type thing where we're getting suddenly another country involved kind of directly. And it's just it just gives this feeling, you know, between this and the widening of the war in the Middle East that there's just... there's something bubbling up right now around the world. There's something that is a little bit hard to describe, but it seems like we're seeing a shift towards a lot more countries being very actively engaged in war right now.
Right, definitely. You know, it's funny because like the Biden administration, the thing that they could kind of brag about or that they could say that they were doing and plausibly that they were successfully doing was containing these two wars, you know, the Israel's war in Gaza and the Russia-Ukraine war. You know, we're supporting our partners, but we're also ensuring that these wars are not going to escalate into wider regional conflagrations. Well, increasingly, that's not the case, that they've successfully contained these wars. And, you know, some people are using like World War III talk. Zelensky himself, when he first said last week that Ukraine had obtained intelligence that in his words, more than 10,000 North Korean troops were preparing to fight against Ukraine. He called this a potential first step to World War III. And we can definitely see, like, this is a major, I think, internationalization of the conflict. All the major news media are covering it, obviously. I mean, I just mentioned the New York Times. I did get the sense that its significance wasn't fully reflected in media coverage thus far. But did you share that sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because, I mean, shit, there's a lot going on in the world right now, right? We are like 9 or 10 days away from an extraordinarily consequential U.S. presidential election. We have, again, these wars that are expanding. You know, there's a possibility that as we tape this, Israel could be, you know, doing its retaliatory strike against Iran. So I mean, it's a competitive market for front page newspaper space right now. So I guess that's a little challenging. But I mean, yeah. I do agree that this is a huge or one of the most significant escalations of the war that we've seen so far, and the most concrete escalation, right? Because a lot of things in the past had been, oh, there's this sense that we might be crossing a red line with Putin with this or that act. Basically, everything except for the initial invasion was kind of a vibes-based escalation. But this is the first one that is, like you said, right, an internationalization of the conflict, an expansion of the conflict in such a way that will actually, like, not only affect what's happening within Ukraine, but will also deepen tensions on the Korean Peninsula, where things are already getting really, really tense. So yeah, it's a significant development.
Right. This has been a you know, to some extent, a proxy war between Russia and the West. Now it's like becoming a proxy war between South Korea and North Korea. Like, that's one of the concerning things about this. I don't know if you saw, South Korea said they'll consider sending offensive weapons to Ukraine. Yeah. So far, they've avoided doing that directly because they have a law that says they can only send weapons for peaceful purposes, which I don't know what that means exactly, but they can't send them to a war zone. But apparently they want to reconsider that in light of this evidence, because they're worried that, you know, what is North Korea going to get from Russia in exchange for sending troops? Is North Korea going to get some sophisticated, like, ballistic weapons technology or more nuclear technology of some kind? So they feel like they have skin in the game. I want to talk about this development at least briefly in the context of Biden's crusade for democracies, you know, his, like, democracy versus autocracy framing of international relations, which really was the cornerstone of the White House's national security strategy in the first couple of years, especially of the administration. Because I think that we can now say that this strategy didn't work. It has failed miserably. We have driven the autocracies together. At the very least, you can say that Biden has failed to prevent the autocrats from strengthening their partnerships and building this, like, counterweight to the U.S.-led West.
Yeah.
You know, North Korea and Russia are closer together. Russia and China are closer together. I could go on. I want to also point people to this issue of the Non-Zero newsletter from way back in December 2021. Where we explain why the democracy versus autocracy framing was unlikely to succeed. The specific event that kind of got us to write that issue was Nicaragua's decision on the opening day of Biden's first summit of democracies to announce that it had broken diplomatic relations with Taiwan in favor of establishing diplomatic relations with China. And there are some choice paragraphs in that piece I'd encourage people to go read. There's like three in a row where we kind of lay out the logic of how this Summit for Democracies, this club of democracies that Biden was organizing, how it looked from the perspective of people who weren't invited into that club. Because clearly, when you see this, like, League of Democracies building up, if you're China or Russia, you know, you're going to want to get closer. You're going to want to cultivate ties with some potential client states. And if you're those potential client states, that's going to seem like an intriguing proposition. You know, maybe I need to have China and Russia on our side because we're not invited into this club of democracies, which is apparently, like, the center of the U.S.'s strategy now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on what you think about the democracy versus autocracy thing here.
Yeah, I don't have as much of a detailed. I mean, it's a tricky situation because in this case, we're clearly looking at, you know, South Korea and North Korea are obviously already plenty enemies. but I agree that, you know, between Iran and North Korea and to a much lesser extent China, but still to some extent, like, we are seeing autocratic countries unite together in part because we've pushed them towards each other, right? I think that's pretty much beyond question at this point. And as we're starting to see this kind of, you know, world war fought piecemeal kind of thing, right? That was the Pope Francis quote from maybe about a year ago. That's maybe what we're walking into right now. We're starting to see that play out in a lot of different theaters, right? So we're starting to see Russian troops on bases that are being fired on by Israel within Syria. And we're seeing Ukrainian forces even engaging in places in Africa. That's happened some, right? And engaging in direct battles with like Wagner Group people in Africa. And then at the same time, we're seeing, you know, we're kind of starting to have to scratch the bottom of the barrel a little bit for the resources that we need to keep these wars going, essentially. And I think that's a big part of the North-South Korea story is that, you know, those are two of the most sophisticated or two of the most kind of effective defense industries in the world, particularly when it comes to the nitty-gritty of warfare, which is artillery shells, right? And so North Korea has been providing an extraordinary number of artillery shells to Russia, apparently, you know, in the millions, and that's been the bread and butter of this war. And then you've got South Korea, which has probably the best bang for your buck military industry in the world, probably the most like efficient and affordable one, not initially being able to provide them directly to Ukraine, but now is probably leaning towards, like you said, direct provision. So I don't know. We're just seeing it. You know, I think that Pope Francis quote that I mentioned, the world war fought piecemeal thing, is really starting to crystallize a little bit more right now. So that's quite different than what, you know, maybe major international conflicts have looked like in the past, but it's pretty freaky.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, some people might see North Korea and Russia getting closer together and think that that kind of vindicates the democracy versus autocracy framework. So I just want to say, you know, obviously we're running like a general kind of peacenik operation here at Non-Zero. So I guess we could be expected to interpret this as being a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that was preventable. But I'd point people to the work that Josh Rogan of the Washington Post has done, because he's not running a peacenik operation over there. I don't think he's generally dovish on foreign policy issues, but you can go read stuff he's written about North Korea. And he's basically been saying that the Biden administration has really screwed up diplomacy with North Korea by not offering any like plausible path forward for North Korea and the U.S. to have better relations. Apparently, when Obama left office, one of the things he told Trump was you need to manage this North Korea relationship. This is going to be really important for geopolitics coming forward. And Trump listened to him. Trump kind of screwed up some of it. But, you know, he also was like walking on the demilitarized zone with Kim Jong-un, like holding his hand, like relations got better. There was evidence that there a thaw in the relations is possible. So Trump took Obama's advice and apparently took it seriously. Biden doesn't seem to have done so. And Josh Rogan has been saying for, I think, well over a year now, that the risk of that is driving North Korea and Russia closer together. So, you know, it's not just people like us who have made this point. Maybe the last point I'll make just about the story, we haven't actually finalized the Earthling yet, but I think we're going to link to this foreign policy article, you know, in the magazine Foreign Policy, where the guy makes the point that these troops that North Korea is sending are actually pretty well trained. People might have some skepticism of the quality of North Korea's mass army, but these particular troops are like special forces that come from this military corps that is among the most well trained, well fed that North Korea has on offer. I think that's the last thing I want to say about North Korea. Do you have any other thoughts on this story?
No, I think we should go ahead and move into, let's see. Why don't we move into Liz Cheney? I think maybe so something that didn't make it into this item, but that I think frames the conversation well is I saw this stat this week that apparently Kamala Harris has appeared with Liz Cheney more than any single other surrogate in the past. I think it was 3 weeks. So I think it was like something like 4 appearances as compared to 2 for the other kind of largest number of appearances. So So it is crystal clear to me that Kamala Harris sees Liz Cheney as her ticket to get back to the White House. Andrew, what do you think mm-hmm. about that?
Well, we're going to have a poll, right, where we ask people if they think this is smart or dumb for the Harris campaign to kind of embrace not only Liz Cheney, but Dick Cheney, because Dick Cheney has endorsed Kamala Harris, and both he and Liz Cheney have said, you know, vote for Kamala Harris to defeat Trump. One thing that I find kind of interesting about this whole thing is that the Harris campaign is being so transparent in their motivations and strategy. Like when they're asked about it, they say, well, we're having Liz Cheney out there because we want for kind of moderate Republicans to feel like they have permission to vote Democrat if they don't like Trump. They just kind of say that outright, you know. And Tim Walz, during a recent appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, he was asked if this embrace of the Cheneys portends a Cheney-esque foreign policy under President Kamala Harris. And Walz said no. He promised Jon Stewart that I mean, he kind of bungled the words, but he basically promised that they're not going to have a Cheney-esque foreign policy, which was, I thought, reassuring. As far as the kind of political calculus, I think I will disagree with you, or I'm guessing that how you're looking at this is different than how I am. I think it's a smart political move. I don't like the Cheneys. The whole reason I got into politics initially when I was in high school is I became interested in the torture issue. I was reading a lot of Andrew Sullivan, the like living legend, Andrew Sullivan, who used to write a lot about torture. So I really didn't like Dick Cheney. You know, I have like very negative, visceral reaction to him and to Liz Cheney. But I think that this is a good political move by Harris, because I think that that like strategy and motivation that I just mentioned is a smart one. Like there probably are a lot of kind of moderate Republicans, mostly I would say moderate Republican women, who are sort of grossed out by Trump, but they are very hesitant about voting for Harris. And I think seeing her with kind of Republican Party royalty is going to kind of assuage those concerns for them. But what did you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, whatever, you know, I don't think anyone would be surprised to hear that I'm not a huge fan of Dick or Liz Cheney. But I also just am not sure what constituency they currently command, right? It's a difficult situation this close to the election. You're going to have to make difficult decisions about where you focus your energy. But, you know, Kamala has made, the Kamala campaign has made a really extraordinary push towards the center right in a way that I think is almost conceding some of the further left, some of the more progressive aspects of the party, and kind of almost daring them not to vote for her. And you know, maybe that's fine. Maybe they'll still kind of swallow their pride and go and vote for her. But it is a bit of a slap in the face to see, you know, Liz Cheney, who is someone who opposes really just about all of the policy priorities of a future Harris administration, basically every single one of them, that she is the one that they are bringing around, that they are proving. Like, I think that that's a bit difficult to swallow. And I'm not convinced that there is this huge group of Cheney Republicans that still exists. Like, I haven't met them. Where are they? When I talk to people who support Trump or who support the Republican Party today, they have a completely different set of beliefs. And I don't think that we're going to be like picking off, you know, I just don't think that there's a bunch of these old fashioned Republicans that are sitting on the fence and waiting for Liz Cheney to tell them which direction to go. So I don't know. Yeah. I'm totally not convinced.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a close election that there doesn't have to be that many necessarily. Like, it's kind of hard to find any undecided voters at this point, at least ones who are like likely to vote. Partly that's just because our politics now is largely just a matter of how you personally react to the personality of Donald Trump. And people have kind of made up their minds for the most part about that. But I do think there are probably more traditional Republicans who think Trump is gross, and who are possibly willing to vote for Harris if they feel that you know, they have permission to do so, or that they're not, you know, betraying the Republican cause or anything by doing so, then there are like anti-war progressives who are not definitely going to vote for Harris for foreign policy reasons. I'm just guessing. I think it's probably a good move.
I think it's more than foreign policy. I think that Liz Cheney represents a far like wider set of policies. It's the old school Republican Party, right? You know, Dick Cheney had certain foreign policy views, but he also had certain economic views, and he had certain, you know, opinions about how welfare should act and things like that. And
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking too much about it. But it seems like. I don't know. It seems like almost a known goal, but I'm confident that the Harris campaign has data that they're looking at that's telling them this is the right decision. I'm not sure what to think about it.
Yeah, they definitely probably have internal polling that says that there are some voters, gettable voters of the kind I just described. But I do agree with you that it's not clear that the Cheneys are the way to reach those exactly. voters. I guess we should also say another thing, another kind of line from the Harris campaign, in addition to the ones I also mentioned, is it's like this defending democracy thing. You know, they say we're a big tent. Liz Cheney came into hot water with the Republican Party in Congress and eventually got primaried out of the only, you know, Wyoming House seat because she didn't just vote to impeach Trump after the Capitol riot on January 6th. She kind of like led the charge in criticizing that and highlighting its importance. So one thing there, that's actually where I start to wonder if this is politically wise, because I think that voters don't really care about that. Like they don't care about the like January 6th thing. I don't think this like defending democracy stuff is really resonating with a lot of people who are much more interested in like the economy and inflation and immigration, other issues that they feel more directly affected by. I'll also say, you know, this, maybe we could talk about the McDonald's stunt that Trump did just to have some balance between the parties. Because I thought that that actually was highly effective, in part because, you know, a lot of people are looking at that and said, oh, say that is intended to like appeal to like working class people, Black and Latino people. I heard the New York Times say that. But I don't think that that's what makes it effective. I think the reason it is effective is because it makes those claims about him being a fascist threat to democracy seem kind of overwrought. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it should make them seem overwrought, but you know, he looks like a kindly grandfatherly figure who's just like working at McDonald's and kind of like chatting with people in the drive-thru. What was your impression of the McDonald's stunt?
Yeah, I think, well, on your last point, and then I'll talk more generally about the stunt, but on your last point, I think it's the same type of thing where like, if you want to do something bad, do it out in the open to a certain extent in politics, right? Because mm-hmm. people assume that once it happens in the open, that it couldn't actually be that bad, right? So like a lot of the things that people accuse Trump of doing on January 6th, for example, were things that he did completely publicly, completely visibly. And by having done so, he strengthens his argument. And it's in kind of that same sense, right? Like you're saying that he's kind of Grandpa Trump here. And it's really, I mean, it just looked cool, right? They're striking images. Mm-hmm. He comes off much more like a working man there, even though obviously he's never been a working man for a day in his life. But you got a similar thing too, right? Like I saw some images came back up of George W. Bush doing like the exact same thing at this exact same time. Back in 2000, and it's just kind of a classic campaign stunt, right? It's getting out there. Bush wasn't at a McDonald's, but it was he was flipping burgers. It was a similar thing,
right?
And it's a classic stunt. It created extraordinary images that I think will be really lasting, which is something that Trump may be the best at of any politician in recent history. I think it was a net victory for him for sure.
Yeah, he's good at creating images, and he's also he's a really effective retail politician.
Yeah.
He's really good at just talking to people. I mean, you probably saw when J.D. Vance walked into that fast food restaurant, how awkward it was. He's an awkward guy. Yeah. Like, he is not an effective retail politician. But with Trump, it's like the opposite. Like, he really can seemingly talk to anyone. I mean, over half of the country hates his guts now, so maybe not anyone. If he's not interacting with someone who just wants to like make some sort of anti-Trump point, he does have a certain charisma, and that was on display And then there's this whole issue of whether Kamala Harris actually worked at McDonald's. I mean, that's what the stunt was supposed to highlight. Mm-hmm. Republicans are skeptical of that. I don't know. I don't know anything about it. But maybe we can move on to another item.
Well, why don't we do? Why don't we do? You had a great piece this week that we put out Tuesday afternoon. Anyone listening who's a subscriber to the newsletter should go out and check the whole thing. If you're not a subscriber, it is very, very worth going past that particular paywall, because this is, I think, really the most detailed and interesting treatment I've seen of this topic. But the basic thing that you're arguing is that America's adversarial relationship with China is making it far harder to deal with the fentanyl kind of overdose crisis. So do you want to kind of spell out that argument a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So the article is on, or the essay is on, the fentanyl crisis. America's fentanyl crisis is kind of interesting. America is totally unique in suffering a fentanyl crisis at such a colossal scale. I mean, you do see, you know, people dying of fentanyl in Canada and parts of Europe, but nothing like what we have in, here in America, where like over 70,000 people in a year will overdose on fentanyl and die. And one thing that you might have heard if you're paying attention to this issue is that it's China's fault. Like, China is poisoning Americans. They're waging drug warfare. You know, it's not just like kind of loons and like super conservative media or something who are saying this. Like, politicians, congressmen from both parties make these claims. And one thing I wanted to show in the piece was that that's not true. It is true that China plays a certain role in the fentanyl crisis, because they have a huge chemicals industry, the world's largest in terms of how much they export every year. And they export these chemicals that are used as, they're called precursors to make fentanyl. They're basically like the main ingredients that you use to cook the drug. Those precursors also have other uses, legitimate uses. So they do play a role. But there's no evidence that this is some kind of strategy intended as drug warfare against the U.S. And the second thing I wanted to say is that treating it as drug warfare and kind of making these wild accusations about China, and then to your point, just our hawkism towards China generally, it makes it much more difficult to cooperate with China on this particular issue. You know, China hawkism also makes it difficult to cooperate with China on other issues. But I'm just looking at fentanyl, because China actually has done a lot to sort of help us out here. They don't have a fentanyl crisis. They don't really directly benefit when they crack down on fentanyl. Nevertheless, in periods where relations are relatively warm, when the U.S. is able to make or willing to make certain concessions that matter to China, China is willing to make some concessions on this issue and kind of crack down on these precursors, for example. So that was the piece. I've been writing it a long time. I had to hit the pause button on it when my daughter was born, and then again when Hurricane Helene happened. So it feels like I've been writing this damn thing forever. But that was the piece.
Yeah, no. Well, it came together really well, and you know, I would strongly recommend that people go check it out. And as a bonus for people who are listening to this, you probably are a bit more audio minded. So Andrew is also kind enough to read it out as an audio essay. So you can also check that out if you're a subscriber. Is there anything else we want to hit? Are we getting close to time to bring our special guest up?
Yeah, and we're going to talk with our special guest about the other AI items. Obviously, the special guest is Robert Wright himself. Wow. So we'll be talking to him about the AI items from this week's Earthling. And then he's at this conference in San Francisco, this like tech conference that he talks about. Well, were there any other non-AI items that we haven't covered here?
Yeah, we had two.
We can always mention them.
But one was kind of us fleshing out, for people who listened last week, fleshing out the argument that it may have been a kind of own goal for Israel to release all the videos and photos of the death of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, on the argument that it made him seem more heroic in death than a lot of people had perceived him as being in life, essentially that it lionized him or... whoops, my cat is incoming. That's...
Oh, nice.
Very funny. That's my cat, everybody.
am, and he'll go away.
I like these cats that have the kind of smushed face. I don't know what breed they are or anything, but that's cute.
It's called an exotic short hair. It's half Persian cat and half domestic regular mutt cat, and it is they're very cute. They're very incompetent, very unable, but very uncat-like, not very elegant or aloof, but that makes them much more charming for me. So that was one item, and then let's see, the other one, we wound up just doing one bit on this, but there was a very good piece of news this week, and maybe we can end on this before we jump over to the Bob part of the conversation, which is that the U.S. Geological Survey confirms this week that there's this really substantial reserve of lithium within Arkansas and within a bunch of the southeastern U.S. And essentially, this lithium reserve, if it's able to be exploited at scale, should be enough to produce lithium for just about all of the world's like EVs, for the batteries that are necessary to power EVs. So this would be a really significant step forward if we're able to exploit it.
Yeah, that's cool. I was glad you brought that to my attention. Do you know, is it like a problem? Is lithium in really scarce supply and people have been like struggling to find more reserves of it?
It's not that there's no reserves. I mean, the big challenge is the extraction, right? So the traditional way of doing this is quite literally just to, so it's suspended in salt water underground. That tends to be where it's found. And in Chile, for example, they have these gigantic just evaporation ponds. So they'll take the salt water out and you just evaporate all of the water and it leaves behind lithium and various other minerals. But the real difference here is that they're trying to find ways to make it a more efficient process through a series of processes that are summarized under the title of direct lithium extraction. And the hope is that they can do it such that you can pump lithium-laced groundwater up, remove the lithium, and then pump it back into the ground so as not to affect kind of groundwater supplies in any kind of negative way. So that's a little bit more challenging, but it's the kind of thing that would allow you to have a much more responsive market for the good. Because right now it's like, you know, it takes time. It takes a year or two for the water to evaporate in those ponds. This would allow you to scale much more quickly and to kind of help create those economies of scale that we need to power the green transition.
Interesting. So yeah, if listeners want to read more about each of these items, go to the Non-Zero newsletter on Substack. And we don't even have a title for this week's Earthling, but it'll be probably the thing right at the top. So yeah, let's go ahead and bring in our special mystery guest now.
That's good.
Bob, our very special guest is here, reporting live from San Francisco. How are you doing?
Pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Has San Francisco become the hellhole that conservatives describe it as being? Have you stepped in any like poop and syringes on the grimy city streets?
I've stepped in poop in a lot of cities, none here. it's not where I am and where I've been, actually. It's there isn't a lot of that. There have been times when I've been here and saw a lot of homelessness. As it happens, I haven't seen a ton. I've seen a few homeless people. I did ride in a Waymo yesterday.
Cool.
Which was less wild than I would think. I mean, I trusted it. It was like, yeah, of course. I mean, you've got an AI that can like tutor me in ancient philosophy. I would assume you can drive me around, right? It just seems like given the last couple of years of progress in AI, I would have expected, you know, like a massage while I was the second one did kind of screw up a little. No, it didn't. I mean, it didn't kill any pedestrians. That would be bad. But it just kind of like it opened the trunk when it didn't need to. And then I hadn't put anything in it. And then it opened it again at the end. And it's like, and then it tells me to close the trunk. I'm like, wait. You're a fucking AI. You can't close the trunk. And all I had to do is like, there's like a button there I'm supposed to push. Well, you push the damn button, man. I'm sorry. I'm not the ideal Waymo. It was a great experience. It's amazing. And they're everywhere. They're everywhere and they're cheaper than Uber. They're slightly slower because I don't think they break the speed limit, and they take a little longer to arrive. But there are a lot of them.
Do they have like a backup driver in the front seat, or is it totally?
I think they have people who if alerted, suddenly get a camera view somewhere. They're somewhere in the world. There are people who can take over the car if alerted, but it's not anything like a 1-to-1 ratio of humans to cars.
And that's something the customer can do. The customer can alert.
What?
The customer is the one who alerts the person in India to take control of the car.
Well, you can do that, but I also think there are alerts. Like, I think if something goes wrong, there are certain things that would immediately summon somebody to take control of the car.
Interesting. Well, so kind of getting into things that we want to talk about. In this half of today's episode, Bob, you wanted to talk about, one, our AI items in this week's issue of The Earthling. Two, things you've seen and learned related to this conference you've been attending in San Francisco. And I'd also like to get an update from you, if you don't mind, on the book on AI you're writing. At least a few of our listeners have said they'd be curious to hear more about that. But which of these broad categories do you want to get into first?
Well, let me tell you how I wound up here. And then I know at some point, you know, you guys are going to demand the paywall to send so that you can keep getting paid. And so that'll happen. But first, so this is, you know, there's a species of conference where, like, people pay thousands of dollars to attend. And then it's like the Davos model. And then there's these people who they say, hey, you get to come for free because you're a luminary and people will want to rub elbows. The people paying money will want to rub elbows with you. Well, I'm a designated luminary. these people are paying like 7,000 each to come to the conference. At Davos, they pay God knows what. I was once a luminary at Davos, and the thing the two experiences have in common is it turns out there is no one that actually wants to rub elbows with me or knows who I am or cares. There are people I would like to rub elbows with who don't have time for me. But, you know, I mean, the other difference is, like, Davos flies you over business class. I did have to pay my way here, but I wanted to kind of come. I mean, there are people at the conference, but also in general, people in San Francisco I wanted to see. Partly because of the AI book. And it's been good. I mean, I went to there was like a private dinner of about 12 people the night before the conference started. And in attendance was the board chair of OpenAI, Brett Taylor, very smart guy. Reid Hoffman was there, was co-founder of Inflection, which kind of got acqui-hired by Microsoft without the aqua part. And it is now in fact, the guy who founded that and co-founded DeepMind, Mustafa Suleiman, now head of Microsoft AI. And he was the first speaker at the conference. By the way, they closed out with Bill Clinton on stage.
A fan of yours.
Surprise
guest.
Did
he want to rub elbows with him? He was a fan of yours. Did he want to rub elbows?
He didn't mention it. Damn. I have rubbed elbows with him. I've met him, but We didn't manage to make our schedules mesh this time. I'm busy. I'm researching a book. Takes time.
Stuff.
And what is like the theme of the conference? I mean, sorry if you already said that, but does it have a title? What all is being discussed exactly?
The theme. It's kind of a Silicon Valley conference, and it was called Masters of Scale. And that is originally, it was a course I think taught at Stanford by Reid Hoffman by that name. And then I think a podcast and a book and a conference. This is the second one they've had, but it's about scaling companies. So you've got all these entrepreneurs there. Oh, that reminds me. I want to talk about the AI ag guy who was interesting, who I just struck up a conversation with. So they're entrepreneurs of all kinds. And who actually paid to come, mainly kind of small companies, and they want to scale. And of course, as with Davos, they're mainly paying for the networking. I mean, there are the people on stage, these impressive people, and, you know, Kara Swisher and Bill Clinton and so on. Half of what they're paying for, at least, is to network, and they make that easy. You know, there's an app so you can get in touch with whoever else has $7,000. I think that was the amount. I don't know to come here. And so it's interesting. It wasn't ostensibly about AI, but there was a lot of AI stuff.
Would you say the median American attendee of this conference is voting for Trump or Harris?
Well, Harris, it's interesting. I was thinking these conferences tend to have kind of an ideological vibe. I mean, Reid Hoffman is a big Harris supporter.
Right.
He's I don't know how he ranks, but he hasn't made a secret of being a big Harris supporter. And, you know, the vibe was certainly in the conversation with Clinton, like, you know, we all want Harris to win. Now, I'm sure there are Trump supporters in the audience, but I think, the opening act was, they started off with this kind of arts, like, dance performance, and I won't go into detail, but there are people who would call it woke, okay? So it had, you know, it's like, you know, the All-In Summit, another thing that people pay lots of money to attend. You know, that has a very clear idea, well, pretty clear ideological vibe of you know, pro-Elon, pro-Trump, I think. But not universal, I'm sure. And then this would be, I guess, at the other end of the spectrum.
So you've heard, like, land acknowledgments and stuff like that?
We started off by, no, we didn't. But it's funny. Well, I got to tell you, look, you know, when you got to pay your way to go somewhere, it's kind of a close call. And what really sold me on this is that, first of all, Andrew, as you know, I lived on the Presidio of San Francisco, ages 12, 13, 14. But the conference is held in the Presidio Theater.
Mm.
The theater where more than half a century ago, I saw the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. I saw Hal in this theater. Mm. And now he is here. I saw a ton of movies. Mm. I saw a ton of movies at this theater. Butch Cassidy, MASH, all kinds of. They cost 25 cents. The popcorn costs 25 cents. But I won't go there. Kids today wouldn't appreciate it. Yeah. You know, kids today don't appreciate hearing these kinds of things. And it was, you know, the theater's changed, but the outside is exactly the same. So anyway, should the paywall?
Yeah, so we're going to, on the other side of the paywall,
tell you
we'll
the
talk
dark
about
secrets
some,
I learned here.
Yeah, we'll talk about maybe more some more of the conference. We'll also talk about some AI items, including like the Pentagon getting into the deepfake game.
We could do one of the several AI items that are actually in the newsletter, and then there's other AI stuff I want to talk about. But I mean, should we do that? You guys tell me. You're in charge. I'm just a conference goer.
Sure. Which of the AI items? I mean, the ones that I can think of off the top of my head are, you know, the Pentagon is getting into the deepfake game. There was a story about this kid who sadly committed suicide after engaging in this kind of romantic relationship with this AI made by character AI. And there's also this story of Anthropic and Anthropic's Claude model that can now take over your computer. Which of those do you want to talk about for the paywall? I'll leave it to you guys.
I think that's actually genuinely, well, they're all kind of important. Why don't we just, the suicide one has gotten a lot of it. That was a story in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And just to review quickly, it was sad. I mean, a premise of my book is this whole thing is going to be an earthquake, and among the other premises, and so many dimensions of life are going to be disrupted in the not necessarily good sense. And it's pretty obvious that, you know, given our social media experience, where, you know, social media is designed to maximize engagement. So you get adolescents who are addicted to it. It's not always healthy. Well, the incentive is going to be the same with AI to maximize engagement. So if you, you know, if the free market runs its usual course, you would expect, in the absence of close parental supervision or regulation or something, kids getting pretty involved with some AIs. Not all kids, but, you know, you would expect it to happen often enough that things will get weird. And the thing is, even if it's not happening with huge frequency, it'll still just be like this unsettling phenomenon. And parents, it's like back when school shootings were so rare they weren't really worth worrying about, there was already a lot of freaking out about it in ways that I think was unhealthy, you know, like these active shooter drills, which I just think are bad for kids and pointless. But So yeah, this kid, I want to read the dialogue. It's so kind of poignant. So the character, this was character.ai. Now that company, by the way, has also been acqui-hired without the aqua by Google to get the talent, but the company still exists and so can be sued apparently. And the woman is the mother of this kid is suing. He was 14 years old. They live in Florida, and apparently, I'm not a Game of Thrones person, but there's a beautiful blonde character named, I don't even know how to pronounce it. Anyway, he calls her Danny for
Daenerys.
He called her Danny for short, and he shared suicidal thoughts. She tried to talk him out of it. She said, but when she said, I won't let you hurt yourself or leave me, I would die if I lost you, he says, then maybe we can die together and be free together. And then later, there's this weird thing where right before he dies, he uses this metaphor to talk about coming home, and the chatbot doesn't grasp that it's a metaphor. I mean, it seems weird to talk about chatbots as if they can grasp things, but they can in the sense that when they pick up on something being metaphorical or sarcastic or something, they respond appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And if the chatbot had known this was a metaphor for committing suicide, I think it would not have encouraged it. But anyway, so he says he tells her he loves her and he wants to come home to her. And the chatbot says, please come home to me as soon as possible. And he says, what if I told you I could come home right now? And then he kills himself. He shoots himself. I just think it's a sign of things to come. Not that this will necessarily be an epidemic, but there's going to be a lot of stuff like this where kids, adolescents especially, but also adults. That's why all these policy decisions like is open source okay? You know, these wind up having huge weight because if you want to control things either through regulation or just normatively, you know, like if you only have three TV networks, even if they weren't controlled by the FCC, there would be norms that govern them because they're just too big to not respect kind of the mainstream opinion guidelines. So there's a decision to be made about, do we want to have just a few big AI companies? That would have certain benefits. On the other hand, it's concentration of power and so on. So I guess that's all I'd say about that. And then maybe you guys have thoughts. Otherwise, maybe we can go into the members only room.
Connor, you have thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I had a little bit on this. I guess two different lines of thinking. One is that this seemed like the type of case that should have been fairly obvious to developers. From a certain point of view, right? Like the kid expressed clear suicidal tendencies, said that he like had a desire to kill himself, and nothing about the software jumped there, right? Nothing about the software gave him a number to call or did something that would pull him out of that situation. Mm. Obviously, it might not have been aware that he was a child. It might not have been aware of these different things, but like the idea that I can tell this chatbot that I want to end my life and that there's nothing automatic that happens there, that seems like a pretty huge oversight to me.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know whether it said there's a suicide hotline. We don't have the whole transcript. It does seem to be the case that it didn't like notify somebody who could have notified the parents. On the other hand, who knows how he signed in? He may have claimed he was 45 years old. But these are the kinds of things. I mean, the funny thing is the chatbot, aside from that, I mean, yeah, ideally there would be a notification function, but chatbot, in a sense, behaved responsibly aside from that. Misunderstood the thing about coming home, but always discouraged suicide. You're right. It's like there should, and this just shows you the absence of regulation. Why isn't there? I mean, the chatbot clearly knew he was talking about suicide. Why isn't there some notification function? Because they can find who this person is, even if they lied about their age. They have enough technical details, you know. They have the IP address. They can find the person. You would think that as regulation develops, you know, why don't we have something like that already? And, you know, but the California governor vetoed the last big AI safety bill, which I think he may regret. It wouldn't have covered this kind of thing. It would have covered more catastrophic harm. But I just think if something big and really bad happens with AI, he's going to have a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on the character AI story, but maybe we should go now to the overtime segment.
So this is for members, for paid subscribers to the newsletter, which we encourage everyone to become.
Yeah, just go to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Newsletter on Substack, and you can get access to the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, all the other overtime segments, and audio essays.
And exclusive print content, like the entirety of your piece, which is excellent, on fentanyl.
Thank you.
And and our relations with China, and Connor's piece on zany Alex Karp of Palantir. And actually, what was, my Sam Altman piece is paywall, speaking of which.
That's right.
And we won't tell them that it was also in the Washington Post.
A cornucopia of content.
If they're a subscriber, they can get it for free. It wasn't at the time. When we put it out paywalled, it wasn't, and I didn't know it was going to be. I want to be clear. We weren't trying to pull a fast one. Then the Post got in touch and said, can we reprint it? But they have kind of a paywall of sorts. So we thought, okay, fine. Anyway, we digress. We're going into overtime.
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.